And we are live for episode 35 of Agency Phonics. Good morning. A very special guest today is Mr. Andrew Dobby from the incredible Made Brave, the founder of Made Brave. Where are you in the world right now?
I'm in Eaglesham, which is just outside Glasgow in Scotland.
All right, okay. So just before we get started, Andrew, which I'm really looking forward to, like this podcast episode has been in the waiting quite a long time for me because I think I've heard your story about 20 times, but I still love it, hearing it every single time. It's like the first time you tell it. So I want to share that with all of our listeners. Just a couple of quick thank yous, as always. Thanks to Forecast, who kindly sponsor our not-for-profit social enterprise agency, Nomics, and Agency Phonics. All of this is done for free. It's our way of paying it forward to the sort of now, next, and future of agencies around the UK. We kind of work a lot with the grassroots agency side of things, but it can't really happen without people like Forecast supporting us. Also, Warhive. Caitlin, our producer today, she's actually in the Warhive office. I think she's the only person there in the studio, which we're streaming live today onto YouTube. So please, if you can, subscribe. I think we just broke 400 subscribers. We're a year in. But we've got to get to 1,000 to earn any money. So we've got a long way to go yet, but really appreciate if anyone could just hit subscribe and help us towards our cause. And that's about it, I think. Yeah, I think I said all my thank yous. We're feeling a little bit more like Christmas every day now. I've got my Christmas tree up next to me here, and I have the fire burning. I actually did a talk last Tuesday to 100 agency owners. I think, Andrew, you might have been. Were you listening?
Yes, I was.
The fire explode at one point, and everyone was sort of thinking that my carpet was going to go up in flames. But anyway, still alive to tell the story. So Andrew, welcome.
Thanks for having me. Hi.
Share with us, especially for those of our listeners who haven't heard your story before, share the story of how Made Brave came about.
All right. I suppose I was a designer and a photographer for 8 years. I worked in a very kind of sort of small agency, sort of no more than sort of 8 or 10 people. I suppose back in 2011, when my little boy Finlay, he was about 2 weeks old, I didn't have much to my name, and it probably wasn't the best time to kind of start a business or kind of go off and, you know, start to work for yourself. But I suppose at the time I suppose it was a money driven thing that my wife was going to be not working because of said child. And so I left my job at the time to head off to be a freelancer. And I never really had ambition to be anything more than a freelancer. I really just set out to kind of, as I say, it was money driven. So I set out to kind of try and earn a little bit more for nappies and childcare and such like. But I suppose from there, Made Brave was born. In that kind of first year from freelancer to kind of creating a business, I think I went from myself to about 6 full employees in that first year, and then the second year we went from like 6 to 16, and then we're now up at kind of 45 people there or thereabouts. So that's the crux of it.
It's a fantastic story, and I'm curious to know is when you first started, you obviously were a freelancer. And you said you didn't really have at that stage ambitions to grow. What changed that? What was the sort of pivotal moment that made you think I'm going to go from freelancer to founder effectively?
Yeah. So I suppose, like, first of all, as I say, I did just think, I kind of thought, if I went to being a freelancer, I could earn a couple hundred quid a day. I thought that was kind of my first goal, if you like. But very quickly, I actually realized that I loved the business part of it. So when I worked in the previous agency, I was a designer, I was a photographer, I was doing the creative stuff. And, and I think when I got out and very early on, I just realized, oh, wow, I love the business side of it. I really got the kind of buzz for that and really enjoyed that. And I think in that kind of first maybe 6 months, I didn't know if this would take off. So I was doing baby photography because I obviously had my son, and I thought, well, I'm going to be around lots of new parents, and, you know, I'm a photographer, so I did that kind of stuff. At the same time, I was doing wedding photography. So I think in my first, the first year of Made Brave, I think I also did about 12 weddings, and I was doing the agency stuff. And I suppose I was kind of, I was doing all three and trying to figure out what would work. And very quickly, I realized with the baby photography, babies don't work to your diary, they work to their own diary. So you know, you couldn't do a huge amount of photography in one day. So I was never going to kind of sort of reach, I suppose, maybe the monetary goals I had at that time. The wedding photography, it's pretty hard work. And I suppose the agency stuff, very quickly I got very busy. And so I kind of stopped doing the other two and kind of put all my effort and everything onto the kind of Made Brave side of things. And I suppose I kind of ran it as a freelancer for a few months, and then I just saw how busy we were getting, and I thought, I suppose I really need to turn this, do what I'm doing for other people, and turn this into a brand, turn this into a business.
And I think that's what I love about that story, is it really resonates with me a little bit as well, because I had three things in my first year as well. I was also doing, you know, you probably had more glamorous. I was earning £100 a day doing cleaning jobs to try and support my first year as a web, an internet agency or a web development agency. And actually I did three things. I used to fix people's computers. I would also, I did a little bit of this thing called field marketing, which was basically sort of helping put people to demonstrate products into like retail stores. And actually it was the internet thing that took off. So there's a little bit of hedging in those early days. But I love the fact that you found other revenue streams, I guess, to keep you going, because that's quite important, right? Before you start winning any clients. And obviously you must have won something reasonably big then, did you, to then suddenly have a team of six people, or was it?
I'm trying to think back. You know, I think I think that way, when you had to, you know, when you suddenly go in from having a secure salary to not having that, you know, I thought, I'll do anything to make sure there's money, you know, coming into the house, kind of thing. And so I suppose I was kind of out and about, and I did lots and lots of networking. I thought, you know, I'm going to find work. And then very quickly, I was so stressed, you know, if I'm being really honest, in that first few months, because I'd gone out and I'd drummed up so much business that I had so much to do. And, you know, so very quickly, I think I had someone supporting me freelance. Then I was like, do you want to work 2 days a week guaranteed? Then very quickly, they were full time. And then, you know, I was sharing an office at the time with someone, and you know, this guy that I was working with was really 10 times better designer than me, was a little bit fed up with the kind of business side of it, of kind of chasing invoices, and was kind of going to leave the creative industry to go and do something else. And I was kind of like, do you want to work for me? And he was like, well, I've got a fam, all that kind of stuff. I need roughly £30,000. And I was kind of, shit, I don't have £30,000. But one thing that was kind of changing for me was that at the time someone said to me, Andrew, you don't need £30,000, you know, to hire someone. And I think, you know, I talk to a lot of people now starting businesses, and they're like, how do I get my first hire, and how do I do that? And it was a really nice kind of bit of advice that someone gave me, is that they said, you know, well, you know, a £30,000 salary costs you about £2,500 a month. And, you know, if you sit down and you have that conversation with that first hire, or, you know, and there's a probationary period, there's 3 months for you to try and figure this out. And, you know, it's there for both parties to make sure that the relationship works and that it's going to work. And so we sat down and I said, I'll try my best to do this. I want to employ you. It's a lot of money. But the way I looked at it was that, well, I suddenly only needed £2,500, or that ultimately the risk was £7,500 for that 3 month contract. And, you know, I think once you know, right, okay, I've got £2,500 to find, you then go off and find that and make more. And, I think, you know, in that first year, I just did that over and over and over. So, by the time I had number one, you know, a second person, and I just kind of kept doing that, you know.
Yeah. I think it's great advice, and you're right. It is a kind of I think it'd be good to. I mean, you probably have got quite a few pearls of wisdom, because I think that you can share around to freelancers looking to make, if they wanted to make that change. Did you ever regret in those early days making that change from going from freelance to having people working for you, or was it instantly? Because sometimes when you scale, it's tougher, isn't it? In some ways, you know.
Yeah, I think, you know, I wrote a post on LinkedIn the other day about this, that there's this kind of pressure for everyone to scale and grow a business. And I don't think it's for everyone. I think, you know, I always say to people when they're asking for my advice in this is that, you know, you've got to kind of try and decide what your vision is and what you're trying to create. And neither way is right or wrong. You know, it's not right what I've done now. It's not right if you choose to be a freelancer. I think you've got to try and decide what makes you happy and what's the right balance for you, your family and your life. And you know, running and growing an agency is not a stress-free endeavor. You know, there's a lot of stress, a lot of effort goes in. But likewise, you know, being a sole freelancer has stresses, and you know, and so I suppose it's trying to find and figure out that balance. I mean, the way I looked at it, and again, it's just my own opinion, is that if I was to stay as a freelancer, I would own a job, and you know, and I would always be having to do. You know, and I'd have to put the hours in all the time to receive income and to kind of keep a living. And I suppose when I had when Finlay was born, I'd started to realise the value of being able to spend time with your family and being able to, you know, I suppose have a little bit more choice around that. So I decided to grow the business because I decided I wanted to almost build, you know, something that was a bit more self-sustaining than just me owning a job. Because then I felt like if I got ill or I couldn't work, then, you know, suddenly you can't provide. And yeah, so I suppose that sent me off on the route to kind of start building a business.
And it is a fluid thing, right? Because I remember, you know, the first step for me was I'm working for myself. I'm in control of my own destiny. And then the second thing was, I think it'd be nice to have like a small team of 8 people, you know, so I wasn't having to do all of the web development, because I remember you're right. It's not always, there are stresses being freelance, because I was like networking and working on the business in the daytime and then building websites in the evening.
Yeah.
I was like, I think at one point I was sort of working 20-hour days going, this isn't anyway a lifestyle or a business. This is actually worse. And actually taking somebody on actually halved, you know, the amount of time I was working initially. But I think it's I think I had 8 in my head and I thought, oh, that'll be it. And then when it got to 8, I suddenly had 20 in my head. And I got to 20, I was like, do you know what? I want to be the largest in sort of the county that I was in, then the south of England. Then it was like, I want to be number one in the UK. And you, weirdly, I don't know where that came from, but I think you're right about aligning your purpose, like aligning your, you know, your vision and your purpose, what it is you're trying to achieve. And there is, I'm with you 100%, by the way, there is no right or wrong. I think I've met people in the last 10 years who have what they would call it purely lifestyle agencies that have made probably more money than some of the people that scaled their businesses up, you know?
Exactly, so, yeah, no, you see some people that scale and then they're earning way less than they were when they were much smaller.
Yeah.
So yeah, there's definitely no right answer in it, you know. What's and right? It's hard as well. I always find it quite funny, is like same as you. And I think, you know, when you talk to anyone that's growing a business or have grown, is that you think, you know, I remember going, right, we'll get to kind of 10 people and that's about right. I've heard that's about perfect. But then once you're in it, it doesn't stop. It's an organic thing, and it's very difficult to just say, that's it. And especially when it's service based, because it's very peaky, you know. So, you know, you can find it very difficult to turn away business when you're busy, or, you know, so it kind of tends to just go and go and go. And so, yeah, you know, I've found that, you know, we'll stop at 20 people, that'll be about the right size. But then you get there and you realize, oh, we're missing this or this or this, and it suddenly jumps to 30. And yeah, and as you know, it continues.
Yeah. And so I think, and also the other, you know, the thing you said about the kind of the, it only costs you 3,000. There was this tip that I got. In fact, it was something that my late mum shared with me. Whenever she said, you want to work out what something is a week, you sort of like, you double it. So it was like, if it's 20,000, you double it, it's 40,000, take off the noughts, you know, it's £400 a week. So I learned this little trick. So whenever I was trying to take on people, I would go, well, if it's 25 grand salary, that's only £500 a week. Now, if I can just sell one designer for one day a week, that pays for the designer or one day of web development. And I had, so I had another little way of kind of working it out.
As long as
I could bring someone on and break even, that was my original plan. I think after that, we sort of, you know, I tend to advise people to know you've sold 6,000 of a service before recruiting someone, so you can obviously cover their costs and everything else. But what's interesting watching you and hearing your story though, is that because you're a creative, and actually what I find typically is with creatives is that they often, and the same with web, same with engineers as well, is, and this is a bit of a stereotypical kind of overview here. I mean, I'm not saying everyone's like this, but they often, you do tend to use a lot more freelancers like in those early days rather than recruit. But you actually recruited quite early, didn't you? Which I think is, do you think?
Do you know what's most funny about that? I hadn't ever really thought about it. But I tell you what, the agency that I came from was a small agency. It was about eight people. And we had never really used many freelancers, right? So I didn't really know how to engage with freelancers or what that was. So I think my automatic was just to go to, I now need someone in the team. And I think very early on as well was I thought, you know, well, you know, it's less in my control. I wouldn't know how to manage that. And I suppose in those early days, you want to kind of control everything because you're very precious about what you're creating. So.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is smart when you do recruit. I know that today you don't have to recruit people to come to an office. You can, you know, everyone can work remotely, et cetera, et cetera. But I think sometimes when you commit to people, I still feel that you can really lock down the culture. Yeah. You can certainly get more commitment back. And I'm not saying you can't scale a business through freelancers. Of course you can. But I think if you have a core team, it certainly helps. And so I think it's quite brave of you, really, I think, to have recruited people. But if you only ever knew that way, then
I was probably quite naive at the time as well, though, in terms of, like, you know, when you look back now, I mean, now, you know, everything, you've got kind of ratios for everything and how you hire and how, you know, and I think back then there's a bit of that entrepreneurial gut and kind of just, you know, I think you need a little bit of the naivety, because if you quite knew what you were getting yourself into, you maybe wouldn't.
Make any decisions.
No, exactly.
What you definitely got right, I think, you know, and anyone who's seen you and knows you, is that I think when I first spoke to you and I first came up to your offices in Glasgow, I'd just come back from America and I'd come from an agency where the brand experience, that the brand was so well created, curated in this agency in North America, in United States, and it was pervasive through the whole business. Mm-hmm. And I came into your, and you were one of the first agencies I went in where I really felt you lived and breathed your brand. The brand experience was pervasive, like everything you touch, from, you know, the childhood toys that you had in the office, you know, that obviously match, you know, your demographic customer, because I don't know, like anyone who's between 25 and 45 could probably find a toy from their childhoods, you know, and it conjured back memories. But more than that, you defined your values, you know, you not only did you get the personal brand and brand experience right, which I make that 2 points, because a lot of people do the branding, but then they don't really live and breathe it. But the second thing is that you also got your personal brand right too. You know, you had the story that you would tell about why you set the business up around that. Remember the cup of coffee? I remember the cup of coffee. And I love that whole story about why, you know, you started moving into brand. But you live and breathe it, Andrew. Like you lead by example, but you get both right. Your company has got an incredible brand that lives and breathes, but so do you as an individual. Mm-hmm. You know, you've actually done, and I think if you look at the most successful agencies in the last few years, you know, and I think, you know, a lot of people probably saw that post from Carrie at Rise Up Seven, and they've grown from 0 to 3.5 million. In like about 2 or 3 years. But again, the key thing there is she's a very, very strong personal brand. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's been really great to watch you use both of those individually and as a company.
Yeah.
And I think that must have really, I mean, through when the sort of lockdowns first started happening through COVID, your LinkedIn presence just seemed to elevate very quickly.
I think LinkedIn have turned on some sort of algorithm, organic juice for everyone at the moment. It reminds me very much of kind of how Facebook was back when I started the business. And I suppose some of that kind of personal brand stuff, I don't know, it's kind of almost like by accident, if you like. And, you know, initially is that when we started growing the business, you know, Facebook, you know, back in 2011, people didn't quite know how to use it yet. And very much, I think what we did that maybe differed from other agencies is that at the time was that because I was a photographer and I had camera in my hands and I had that skill set, as I was growing the business, we were just literally having fun. And, you know, and a way that a lot of Made Brave looks and, you know, the stuff that we do at Made Brave is because I say to our team, look, you're there more than we are at home. Not anymore, right? Enough for now at home more. But, you know, let's make sure we enjoy it and let's have, you know, have a good time while we're growing a business. And so we were always doing that stuff, but we were documenting it. And at the time we were putting it on Facebook. And it was literally no more thought to it than let's just document this journey and put it out. And now we all know that documenting journeys on social media is kind of the best way to use it. If you put your work up on social media, you know, you're the same as 22,000 other agencies in the UK. So, yeah. You know, you're always trying to find, you know, you don't want every customer in the world and you're never going to get every customer. You want ones that get you, that understand your values, that understand your team. And likewise, for recruiting new team members, you want people that get the Made Brave, you know, values. And, you know, because if they don't, they're not going to work, they're not going to enjoy it. So, you know, I suppose the way we've always used social media is to put out what we're about. And I perfectly know that that's going to attract people that will dislike it. But in a sense, it's kind of good because it's like, well, good, I now know that you're not for us and the people that do like it are for us. And it means the customers that come to us for that stuff, we're going to get on, we're going to create great work. And, you know, as I say, you know, team members as well, we're going to have a better relationship because, you know, they know what to expect when they get in.
Yeah. So can you talk us through a couple of examples of your values?
Yeah. I'm a big believer in kind of values driven business. Kind of, you know, values are kind of like, I suppose they're kind of the beliefs that you have in the business, behaviors that you want to encourage. You know, for Made Brave, the first couple of years, actually, we let the kind of culture grow organically to kind of see. We knew we had something and, you know, we saw that it was attracting attention and engagement, but we didn't put it down on paper straight away. And I think there's something quite good in that just let it go a little bit. And then what we did was, as a team, we tried to figure out what is it that we've created here? What are the special things? And so I suppose, like, you know, some of the values we have are, we've got amigos without egos. So Mexican food was just a thing that was always, you know, we always got burritos on a Friday. It was just something we liked as a team. But then we kind of used that Mexican theming into the kind of amigos without egos. And that value is all built around that the best idea can come from anyone. And often actually it doesn't even come from us in the team. Often when your client sits in the room, it's in them already, the answer to their brief. It's just our job as creative people to pull it out of them. And I suppose that value is based around that idea of just let the best idea come from whoever. Don't let anyone have an ego and say it's got to come from them. We've got another value called be your weird self. I think values are great because as a leader, you often have to, you know, when you're doing all hands or you're looking after a group of people, you have to find ways to be able to talk about difficult subjects. And, you know, the be your weird self one was built around the idea that, look, we're all weird and wonderful in our own way, right? We're all different. And that's what makes great teams, is that you're different from me, I'm different from the person beside me. And the sooner we all understand that and understand the people around you are different, the more you can respect them. But we also used the be your weird self platform as a platform to talk about mental health. Mental health's often a very difficult thing to talk about anywhere, but especially the workplace. And, you know, for years and years and years, we've all been told, leave your worries at home and, you know, come into work and be professional. And I was kind of like, why don't we not do that? And why don't we realize that we're human beings and look after each other? And my thought being that, you know yourself, you lead a business. There's a big responsibility on your shoulders to look after the people in your team. And I suppose I kind of felt that, you know, let's make this make these topics easier to talk about, and then, you know, people should feel safe coming to work. And likewise, if I'm struggling, you know, and I do, and people struggle, and, you know, we all have pressures in our life, I would hope that in return, if, you know, if you need looked after or cared for, then your team will do that as well. So obviously we've got loads of, you know, more values. You can find them all on the Made Brave site. There's, you know, we put a lot of effort into them, and we really put a lot of effort. And I think the most important part that, you know, for anyone listening that they're creating values in their business is that, you know, values only mean something when you put them into action. So, you know, you can't just write these things, put them on a PDF or put them on a word on the wall. It's like, you know, what we've really, really started to focus on as a culture at Made Brave is, how do we bring these things to life? How do we make sure and prove that we're living and breathing them? How do they affect policy or everything that we do in this world? And I think brands in general are starting to wake up to this, and it's quite nice to see, because, you know, the world now is very transparent and seeks transparency, because we're all connected in this ever connected social media. And, you know, I think the change that's coming is, as I mentioned, is that you know, we can't just say we have, you know, this purpose or these values. We have to, you know, truly show it. And I think that's a good thing.
Yeah, it's interesting, because we're currently rewriting Agencynomics at the moment, and I went back and visited some of the early chapters, and basically in there I remembering back to my early days, I found it very hard to define a lot in the early days of Blue Halo. Like I was more of a techie than a creative, so for me it was quite hard to maybe focus on my branding, you know. I also I didn't really know where to focus. Like it was until I turned over about £1 million and I'd won like a Premiership football club. Mm-hmm. I didn't really know that sport was going to be my focus, you know. Mm-hmm. And so the values as well. Like I love what you just said then, by the way, about the kind of organicness to it, because I think sometimes you do have to go on a bit of a journey. And it is business as normal, and that's the reality of it. You know, most entrepreneurs, when they set a business up, contrary to belief, don't have a plan. You know, they are iterating on the fly all the time, trying to adapt and learn and hear where the demands or where the problems are that they can solve. And I think that the values for me, it's funny, because I think our values almost weren't written down for probably quite a few years, you know, but there was this, but there was something around the recruitment, which is, you know, like they always say, when you do recruitment, you should always try and recruit around the values. You should always ask for people, you know, so explain what, you know, you probably do in your ones. You say, if one of us be your weird self. So what's weird about you then? You know, like you want to hear those stories. And I guess when we were interviewing, we always had certain things that we looked for, but I love about your values is that you've taken time to kind of make them fun and playful in a way, you know, the way you've written them. You haven't just written down, you know, mastery, autonomy, cause, community, or whatever purpose. You've actually come up with something that is really creative and fun, right? And so something that everyone can believe in as well. So
I think that's a big part of kind of, you know, how you get branding right. And not to say I've got it, you know, perfect. But what I mean is that, you know, a lot of people do write down integrity or, you know, professionalism. And I'm kind of like, surely that's a given, right? Surely we have to have integrity and be professional. Yeah. So that's kind of like a Made Brave. Those things, I expect those to be there. We expect them as a team, that you're going to look after each other. You're going to be professional to your customers. You're going to have integrity. And I almost feel like the values are a layer on top of that. It's the thing that uniquely only you have, or your culture, your team have. And I think, you know, I think when you do it well, is, you know, there might be a foundation of those elements, those words, but try and find a layer where you add your own personality to it. So, you know, great brands have really distinctive personalities. And I think that's one focused on at Made Brave, was to try and, what does Made Brave sound like? You know, if Made Brave is a person, if you can hear that voice and you visualize all the content, all the actions that we've taken, you know, what does that feel like? And, you know, you see brands like Oatly, for example, hugely scaling quickly, very distinctive personality. You can, you know, you can see it in your mind's eye right now, you know, without knowing everything they say, and they've taken their values, they're putting them into action, and they're making sure it permeates through right through their business. So it's you know, it's a topic I could literally talk for hours on. So
and so you're with your with the other thing that that just is my observation of you, that you do really, really well, is that you do, like, you've built this, I call it a fame strategy, really, but in a way, everything that you offer as a service, you kind of don't just talk about it, you walk it, right? You actually, you know, you, everything that your clients would want from you, you do yourself, you know? So I loved, for example, and there's been quite a lot of examples, things I've seen you do over the years, but obviously, if I wanted to make my brand more famous, I would probably come to you, because I can see when you do things, you don't do them by halves, and you come up with quite, you know, you're from filling up your office with loads of toy balls to whatever, like Christmas, dressing up as a Christmas tree I saw the other day. And, you know, all of the things you're doing are, but I particularly liked, as you said, when you first started, maybe Facebook, not everyone really knew the power of the marketing there, but if we go back to just 7-8 months ago to March, you know, TikTok was, I literally had just taken my account off, because I went on it because I always like to be on what's next. But the average age on TikTok was about 14 years old 7 months ago. And I was like, this is just not my demographic. I'm out of here. And then, but you have then kind of taken that platform, you know, with your son, created some amazing content that obviously really lifted up, and it did two things. One, it showed your creativity, but two, it showed actually how brands could use it effectively, and also let everybody knew that you could use the platform, right? And so that's been really great examples there. I mean, did that have a positive effect on
Well, I think maybe the lesson through all of that, and it's not specifically just a TikTok, but I think the thing that you've coined on there is that I always felt that how can I advise people how to grow a brand if I can't prove that I could do it myself? And, you know, when you run a branding agency or you do projects with clients, you only do part of building the brand. So the one place I had control to grow a full brand was my own. And because I'm a creative person, you know, I was a designer, etc. You know, when I came off the tools, if you like, as a designer, I lost the bit where I get to create. And so I put that Brave, and that's what became my plaything, if you like, to get my creativity, you know, and keep my heart singing, if you like. But it lets me try and test everything, so then I can say from real certainty what works and what doesn't. And so, you know, so that's the same with TikTok. You know, I see a new platform appearing, and I think, well, I better go and try it out and try and figure it out and try and understand how the thing works. But also, I mean, at the same time, that literally was just doing that because lockdown as well, and my son was with me all day, and I thought it'll be fun for both of us, and it gives us memories to look back on. But you're right, it's like, as soon, you know, it's funny because, you know, before I did any TikToks with Finn, you know, I started, and, you know, we thought, let's do one or two a day, and we did it, and it was a kind of little kind of passion thing for us both. But very quickly, I got inbound inquiries. Oh, you're a TikTok expert. Can you come and run some webinars? Which forced me to go and learn more about TikTok, which forced my team to learn more about TikTok. And then next thing, we're talking more about TikTok, and we're doing it with some of our biggest clients. So, you know, so yeah, I think
I think, you know, when you're a tech business, they're really good at pivoting, right? You know, they'll have this idea, and then normally at some point they realize that just because it's a great idea, the timing may not be right, or the market needs something else, and they'll pivot their product or their service. They do it really, really well. And agencies historically have normally been pretty bad. Like in 2008, most of the big agencies had completely missed anything to do with digital and just basically end up having to buy all the agencies up to be able to offer it in-house. And, or they always used to call it the dark arts department in the big agencies. And I think the same thing still happens a little bit now in the larger agencies. They don't, sometimes they get set in their ways a little bit with what they know. But when you're kind of like a challenger agency and you're up and coming, you're much more, I think you're, and I think what's happened, certainly in the last 6-7 months, I've noticed a lot of agencies have been a lot more open to look at this now, next and future of their services, and actually constantly having one eye on what's next. And you have to evolve your business these days moving forward so much faster than any time in history, right? I mean, it's exponential growth on the business, on the way businesses operate, let alone because technology is at the heart of everything we do. So I think that it's great that you're doing that. And it's also great that you have a culture and a team who are willing to learn new things. But you don't have to always... So a lot of people say, oh, yeah, you're wrong to try and sell what you don't do. Mm-hmm. But actually, sometimes you've got to learn what the next thing is, because what you do now just can be done in-house, you know, maybe in 10 years from now, or more automated. So I think it's great you're doing that. And I love the fact the team, you know, also embraced it and learned that. And I think that's going to be the winning success for an agency in the future, is being able to constantly, through their own projects, like their own fame projects, but also through their using their customers' brands where they can, mm-hmm. trying to use them as test beds almost. Yeah, that experimentation, from planning to experimentation, and trying to actually keep moving forwards, testing new platforms. And as you say, it works, because, you know, once you're actually showing and demonstrating people you can use TikTok, then people are going to talk to you, right?
And it's the same with, you know, like we mentioned earlier, we turned one of our offices into a ball pit. You know, as soon as we did that, right, it's fun for us for that week until you have to clean these things up, right? It's great fun, but what it does is, following on from there, you get brands going, I saw that, could you do something similar to us? So it's like... Yeah. You know, I get people are busy, but I think it's a really, you know, easy one to use your own brand to be able to kind of showcase what you're able to do. Yeah. And it also attracts back what you want and what, you know, what fulfills you and your team as well. So
I love that when you describe that, then, is the fact that that's because you've had to hang up the tools, because that's often quite a big challenge for anyone who's a coder. Or, I mean, for me, it was easy because I was a rubbish front end web developer. So as soon as someone else came in better, you know, and I'm not a great creative. So, yeah, that was brilliant. But you know, like me, I didn't want to lose still that creative thinking, you know, the stuff that I got passionate about technology, you're passionate about, you know, design, creativity and brand. And I love the fact that you get to, as you say, use that in your role now to play and to experiment and to create these things. So
yeah, no, likewise, you know, I've realized very much I was a mediocre designer. Now that I see what great designers are that I have in my team, you know, I was very much mediocre. But yeah, you know, I think it's, again, it's like that kind of freelancer agency owner question. It's not right for everyone to hang up the tools. It's right for some. So, you know, I do see some creative agencies that are trying to grow and they're struggling. And it's often when the owner is holding on to, I have to be the designer, I have to creative direct, I have to run that. I suppose, again, it kind of, for me, it was just something someone said to me early on, was that, you know, you kind of need, if you want grow this business and you want to create a business, then if you come off the tools, you know, try and work towards an empty desk. And that one stuck with me, actually, that, you know, if, you know, and it sounds very egotistical, you've an empty desk and nothing to do, but I don't mean it like that. All I mean is that, you know, when you're leading the business, if you work towards the vision of having eventually an empty desk, that anything that lands on your desk, there should be someone better around that's much better at doing that task and is much more fulfilled at it than you. So you've got someone that, you know, operationally, they like doing operations, they're going to take that bit, financially or creatively, whatever part of the business. So, you know, till you get to that point where you actually have the headspace to be able to look after, care for these people and figure out the direction that you have to take your agency to make sure that all the jobs that have been created are going to be there for the future.
Yeah, great. And so one of the other observations I have of you as well is that you always seem to have advisors around you. On your journey, you've always put good people around. By the way, first of all, I just want to echo what you just said. I think you put a really good team around you know, I know some of your team members, and I can see you, well, I always call it the Richard Branson thing, where you sort of find the things you're not so good at, the roles and the skills and the attributes, and you put a really good team of very different people around you who are good, strong, like Stephen, operationally and sales and, you know, all that side of things, and I think that's really, really good. But you've always had advisors, and it's funny, when I look at the most successful agencies, they often have really strong, good advisors around them. Why do you use advisors? Why have you brought advisors on your journey? I think from almost early stage, you've had people
around. Well, The first 2 years I didn't, because you can't afford them when you first start, right? And and I also didn't quite understand how it all worked when I was, you know, first couple of years, you're learning everything. So first, but they were probably the most stressful 2 years of my life, you know, because you're trying to learn everything yourself. But yeah, now I very much see the value in advisors and very much see the value in having people around me. I mean, the more you learn, the more you learn you don't know. And that's very much, I mean, Maybrave's a small business. There's businesses of vast more size and experience than us. And I think what now, again, you know, very early on, I seeked a mentor. I was like, oh, I need to find someone that's done this. And I hadn't, you know, back then, Agencynomics and, you know, these kind of support groups weren't here, which I get huge value from now. But, I, you know, at the time, I didn't have anyone. And, I was seeking another agency owner. And I met one of the founders of one of the biggest agencies in Scotland very early on, I think in year two. And, you know, I seeked him out and sat, can I take you for lunch, please? I want to pick your brain. And I sat down and he asked me, like, what have you done? What's Maidbrave doing? And he said, you know, Andrew, you've done in 2 years what took me 9 years to do. You don't need me as a mentor. And at that point, I got an opposite of me, if you imagine, right? So I found someone that was an expert in finance, and that became my mentor. Because so I've got a great guy that we catch up every so often, and his world is totally different to mine. But what's great about it is that, you know, I can pick his brain and learn things that I'm not learning in what I'm doing day to day. But likewise, I can give him value back, so I can share things that he's not learning, so I can talk about brand, and, you know, and so there's a really good relationship. But nowadays at Maidbrave as well, you know, we've obviously got Mark from Cactus on our board, and we're starting to build an advisory board, because I really do see the value in having different points of view and people that can challenge you and support you as well. I suppose one thing I would do differently if I could is go back to early me and tell me to get bored as quickly as possible, because it's one of the best things.
I was wondering, was it something to do with the kind of MMA stuff, because of the fact that you have this background where you did competitive sports, and was it in competitive sports, you always having, was it Tiger Woods has like 8 coaches or something, you know, to improve his swing, or, you know, but it, you know, you as a, in sports, you'd always give yourself a, put, you know, surround yourself with advisors that can improve your form, right?
Yeah.
But it's interesting for me in business how I just see the vast majority of people don't have people with them. But it seems like a maybe for the early guys, you're right. Maybe there is an element of cost to it. But it's certainly that saying, you know, you don't know what you don't know. That's the thing I think I've learned the most. I mean, I did the same as you. I went originally to my big competitor down the road. And he was always a little bit bigger than me. So I'd go back and say, right, what does 2 million look like? What does 3 million look like? And he would tell me, and he was right. Everything he said came true. So, for me, it was the accountability of having a non-exec, you know, for me a little bit, just kept me on track.
I love your sports analogy there. You know, when you mentioned I did MMA, and I never thought about it this way until you just said that. But when you're fighting professionally or in any sort of way, it's not you on your own that's fighting. You're in the ring, right? But you're listening hugely to the coaches behind you. And it's them that are guiding you. And it's them that have an outside perspective of what is happening. And I think, you know, that's a really nice way to think about it, is that, you know, it's very much a team sport, and that board, they're not in the day to day, and they're not blinded by the day to day stresses that you have. So they can often have a much better view of what's happening to you. And if they've been there before or had similar experiences, they can share those. So I think when you think about it that way, it's invaluable, isn't it?
I think, yeah. And it's also, I think, the acceptance that it's okay not to have to know everything, right? It's okay. Like, you know, you've said it yourself, it's okay to go and ask someone for a piece of advice. Or I always remember when I went to, I did a talk in Edinburgh, feels like 3 or 4 years ago. And it was, who's the guy? Ian McAteer? No, I'm trying to think who was the big agency that sold to, anyway, it doesn't matter who it was, but yeah. I did a talk, and one of the agencies in the room was like at like 5-6 million turnover.
Yeah.
And All the rest were, let's say, somewhere between half a million and a couple of million. But the person who made the most notes, I always remember looking as I was talking, and it must have had three pages of A4 of everything I was saying, and came back and just said, you know, everything you said we used to do, but we've just got along the way, we just got a bit lost. We just kind of started getting into bad habits and stopped doing it. It was like, this is gold dust. And it's so funny that actually I think you've got to want to learn. You've got to be, I think sometimes there's an imposter syndrome issue where you think you have to know everything, so you're prepared to sort of let down, you know, and say, look, I'm happy to learn. Mm-hmm. But it's just an interesting observation with you, because I've always seen you with different people over the years. It's almost like sometimes I call it sort of like when you get to a black belt in karate, you go and do your dans, you get to different masters, don't you? And you have different techniques, different approaches. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a really smart thing to do. So what's next for the business now? I mean, actually, in particular, I wanted to talk to you about, because going into lockdown, you had just invested in an amazing, incredible new office.
Great timing, huh? And,
you know, your old office was just probably my most favorite office I've been into. Yours and one other, I've just, one of my two favorite ever. And you moved this new amazing, and then obviously we all went to lockdown and remote working. Now, I saw you had a lot of publicity about what you were doing moving forward. But could you share with us what your plans are now? Mm-hmm. You know, how do you see the office of the future really as well playing a role in your business?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's always been a huge part of our culture, you know, the living, breathing aspect of it that you mentioned is that I really do believe the environment that you're in or that you work in has a big effect on how you behave and how you feel. And so, you know, kind of early on, we always put a lot of effort into that. And, you know, at the start, kind of early on in my journey, I was lucky to, I went to San Francisco and got to visit the likes of Facebook, Twitter, Dropbox. And I saw how much further ahead they were in terms of just the kind of environment. And I brought some of that back to Made Brave. Obviously, we didn't see the COVID thing happening. We didn't see this. But we did, the lease that we signed was an 8-year lease for the new Made Brave space. Now, we signed that last year and, you know, we've got about 45 people, and the space, the way we have it configured, will hold about 50, 55, 60 perhaps, you know. So we always knew we were going to grow beyond that studio, and we always knew that we were going to have some sort of hybrid approach where we have people located elsewhere. And so we were working towards that. And, you know, I really do believe in the power of flexible working and being flexible around, you know, people's lifestyles. However, COVID did what it did to everyone else, and it pushed us all 10 years ahead of where we are now. So I suppose very quickly we kind of sat down and thought, well, why don't we just lead the way here rather than waiting for everyone else? Because if you put out what you want to receive back, well, you'll attract the conversation, you'll take all the learning, and you'll be able to implement it. So we very quickly launched a work from anywhere policy before we have even written the policy. And that's the key part here, is that we created the vision of what we wanted to now create, or where we wanted to be as a business. Obviously, we've all been working remotely since March, and we're all still working remotely. But the idea being now is that, you know, I kind of just want to have it where, be where you need to be and do what you need to do to run the business. And you know, I like the flexibility, since I've been a director of, you know, I can work around family time and things that I like to do. And so my real thought is if I can get that to happen for our team, that's my goal, is if I can make the balance great for them and we can run the business and, you know, we can still be profitable and pay for everything, then that's the ultimate vision. And I got stressed a few months ago because we put this out and then we started to try and write down a policy. It's very difficult because there's so many nuances and variables and everyone's got a different opinion about it. But, you know, we started working with a company called Flexibility Works. Look them up. They're all about just trying to help create culture that's flexible. And they said to me, look, don't feel down on yourself because you've not got it down on paper. It's great that we have a vision. This is what we're working towards. And so we're now working as a team. We're now trying to figure out what this looks like, what ideal looks like. You know, we've done a lot of kind of internal surveys. And I think the general approach we've seen is that people they kind of want, you know, a couple of days working from home, a couple of days working from the studio or the office. But ultimately, you know, as I say, you know, I'm really trying to make it as flexible as possible. And I think, you know, we're hiring three roles at the moment. And what we've seen, the difference in terms of, we've now got people from all over the world applying for roles. So it's really nice in terms of, like, you know, how diversely we build our team, how we can have people in different locations, which can obviously bring business opportunity that you won't get if you have your team in one location, because, you know, purely by osmosis, if you have someone, you know, in a different city, you're going to get, you know, you get business inquiries from that as well. So I can't see anything but benefits if we can iron out all the little variables.
I think it's interesting because, again, it's that there's no right, no wrong. I think, you know, there's been a real momentum around sort of global, you know, 100% agile, distributed agencies with no offices, literally having, you know, flexible workplaces near their clients or near where people live, so they can go to a working environment if they don't want to be at home. But the three agencies that I know that all have probably the highest, let's say, and, you know, highest culture scores, where it's scored, like using Office Vibe, all of those people, the office is very at the heart of the culture. And actually, and although I think the number you quoted then was about right, it feels like about half the people want to go back on a regular and half don't, sort of thing. And the reality is that, and time will tell with that, but it's, you're right, as long as you have a flexible first approach, and as long as people don't have to sit in traffic jams and commute anymore, I mean, I've kind of already got to a point now where even for me, I'm thinking, you know, do I really want to go post all of this and sit in a car for 2 hours or fly? I just don't, you know, I may as well just do it remote now. It just, because you lose so much time. So I think you're right. The world has moved forward quite quickly and quite well. And I think one of the other things is that I think a lot of people who set businesses up are often control freaks. They don't, you know, there is a trust issue with their team. I don't think you're one of those people. I've not seen that. And I know it wasn't, but it's going to force to actually improve, I think, a lot of business leaders who maybe have been mistrusting of employees before, or created workspaces around or work cultures around maybe, and processes around, you know, the one in time it goes wrong, rather than kind of making it an environment that, that sort of just trusts everyone to do a great job. And if they don't, well, you can deal with it. But I think your approach, so will you redesign your office at all? Will it be, you know,
we're kind of calling it like a, you know, brand home more, is that it's a place that you kind of, you know, I think if you can make it an environment people want to be, then, you know, you kind of want, you know, we're social creatures. I like being around human beings as well. I don't want to sit in this. I kind of say I'm being like Father Jack sitting in this chair every day from Father Ted. You know, you don't move off these chairs. You know, I think we do need that interaction, and, you know, and a lot of great creativity comes from the energy that you pass between each other as well. So, you know, our studio has always been an experience as well as a place of work. And, you know, there's a certain energy in that environment, as I mentioned earlier. And I think, you know, I was thinking about it recently. What if we didn't have an office at all? Would I feel fulfilled? And I think there's part of me that likes that. It's the kind of made brave playground almost. It's a place that we can bring a lot of things to life. And yeah, there's something nice. And I think losing that, you could maybe lose the heart and soul of some businesses.
I think you've got it spot on. I think, you know, it's definitely going to be the situation that if you create almost a second home, you know, if you create somewhere that people want to go and spend time, that can work, but they can socialize, they can interact. I think that will be the change, I think, that everyone sees. And some people will want permanent desks in the office because they need to get out of the home.
And that's a thing you've got to remember as well, is like, you know, you sometimes, when you're creating these things, you look in your own environment and, you know, you think, oh, it's nice working from home, but you've got to remember that everyone's at different life stages. And, you know, I think back when I was younger, and some of the flats I lived in, when I shared with multiple people, I couldn't have really focused or done any work at that time. And so sometimes for some people it's the breakaway, or sometimes they may be caring for people in the house, and so sometimes they need the breakaway. And I think as well, is one thing that I've noticed is that you miss a lot of the learning that you get from overhearing conversations, and you also get to stop challenges or problems before they become challenges and problems, because you can see physically people or hear conversations. So yeah, I think there's still a place for it, and you know, I don't think it's going away, but I think it will. We're not going to see everyone go back to normal, I think, but I think that's a good thing, because you know, yeah, we're seeing that trust.
You're right on the diversity side of things as well, because you know, I think it's been very hard for some agencies to create more diversity in their agencies, you know, for many different reasons, but geography can play a major challenge on that. And it can, you know, and I think actually you can attract much more, you know, better range of cultural diversity, you know, from your business by being more global, being able to have people work from all around the world. And also, as you said, open up your opportunities. I think it's funny, I always say pre-COVID, I always thought the agencies in Scotland always seem to be really good generally at distance selling. It's almost like
we've got to be good. There's not enough business in Scotland, unfortunately.
And I think the rest of the country will benefit, you know, because in some ways you've always had to work that way. I mean, yeah, you probably jump on planes a lot and, you know, but maybe there's been more video conversations before with clients. But I think I've already seen it now. I've definitely seen more international work coming in. And I think that's can only be a good thing for everyone, really. So,
yeah, I think about 80% of our business is out with Scotland now. So
is it? Wow.
Yeah, it's huge. I mean, I would need to run the numbers to see exactly. But, you know, my gut's telling me the majority is now no longer within, you know.
Amazing. Yeah. So what's the plans for the future for you guys? I'm going to imagine that we're all hoping that by next spring, most people will be coming back to some kind of normality. But where are your plans for the future? Is it just expanding more? Do you think having a more global team will be the next step?
Yeah, I think definitely that's definitely one of my focuses. You know, I think like everyone, we felt the effects, March, June, July, and everyone went into panic mode, and, you know, no one knew what was happening. But I think, you know, very much we've adapted to kind of, you know, a lot of our business and stuff came from, we do a lot of talking, public talking kind of in person. So yeah, we very quickly had to shift that onto online. And as a team, you know, we've been really focused on that, on kind of getting, you know, making more of an effort, more noise online. And I think, you've got to remember that this is all we've got now at the moment. We don't have, you know, physical appearances. And so, you know, I think moving into this year, we were kind of obviously, you know, driving through this the last few months, seeing what was happening and how everyone was adapting. But, you know, we found a huge increase in, you know, sales over the last few months. And, you know, I'm feeling really confident now going into, you know, into the beginning of the year. And yeah, definitely kind of focusing more on kind of growing more of that international business and kind of keeping that happening. So
yeah, I'm with you, by the way. I mean, I wrote a post a couple of days ago on LinkedIn about this. I think I've never in 20 years of going to agencies seen pipelines as big as I've seen them as an increase in the last quarter. And I think it's because, and yes, of course, there are some people that were massively affected by those sectors. I've said this a few times now, but on the whole, technology at the heart of marketing and advertising and at the heart of sort of business transformation, especially accelerated by COVID, is just a growing area. And as such, you know, if you're involved in any marketing or design or branding or advertising or digital development, whatever, you know, technology is at the heart of your clients and also your own businesses. And so I think that's what's really driving things forward. I can't see next year being, I think there'll be a few areas hit next year, but I generally think it's a good time for agencies right now.
It's, as you say, it's difficult because it's you know, some have been really heavily affected. It's all down to kind of what industry you were in. And
yeah, exactly. You
know, yeah, I mean, you know, we at Made Brave, we've always, you know, brand is the thing that we focus on. So we've not niched on a sector. And I think, you know, I've always kind of looked at myself and thought, you know, Andrew, you should niche, because, you know, sometimes people preach that niching's better because you get that kind of concentrated focus and you grow. But
you niche your services reasonably, don't you?
Niched around the core of brand. But I suppose industry-wise, you know, I've always played away from that because, you know, as you see, if you were niched around the wrong thing there, it could be disastrous.
Pharmaceuticals, which never seem to get affected by anything. Every other sector at some point gets hit. So I'm with you on always been a bit of a fan of not, if you do niche a sector, still have a, you know, have a wide enough reach around it that you can pivot if it does get into trouble. So so I'm just getting a little sign from Caitlin there to warm, give me notice. So listen, it's been great speaking to you. I feel like it's been, I've got a little bleep coming then, that's funny. But it's been it's always quite cathartic speaking to you because I can really relate. When I hear your story, it's actually, I think it's very, you know, underlying, there's a lot of commonality there between a lot of people that I know, their stories. And it's great to spend some time with you. I love your whole approach to your brand, your personal brand. I think the way you've built the fame up for your business, you've done a great job on that. And I'm really fascinated to see how next year, what are you affectionately called? The May Bravers, is that what they're called?
Yes.
Your tribe. I'd love to see how that's going to work, you know, in this new world order around, you know, will you actually do certain days, set days in the office, do you think? Or will you literally say come in when you need to come in or for clients, do you think?
I think it's just as and when you need. I think we'll do. I think
I'd love to see how that all what the footfall show looks like as they're doing retail. Find out exactly how many people come in and when and what happens. Yeah.
I mean, I think what we've said and I've said to our team is, look, let's try this. If we need to go back, if we need to revert, if we can't get it working, well, let's revert. But let's, you know, if you don't try, you don't, you know, you don't change and adapt. So I think it's just having the willingness to try. And I'm sure it'll be, you know, it won't be pain free because you've got, you know, I think it's, I was always kind of like, oh, can you do flexible working as a service based business? Because you feel like, oh, we should have people there from 9 to 5. But I think, you know, when we end before COVID, when we introduced flexibility in terms of like starting anywhere between kind of, I think 8:30, 9:30 or 10:00 in the morning and finishing, you know, whenever you wanted to a certain degree, it didn't change anything. It just gave people more benefit and, you know, more control in their life. So I think this is just, this should feel uncomfortable just now because it's new to everyone. So, you know, the more vocal we are and the more we all talk about it, the better we learn best practice, and eventually we'll figure out what this kind of new world order, as you put it there, quite like that, looks like.
Great. Well, listen, thanks for your time. I know you're a busy man. You've got lots going on at the moment. So I appreciate you sharing your story with everyone today. And and that's it, folks. Hope you've enjoyed this episode. Keep liking and subscribing, please, on the YouTube channel, obviously on Spotify as well, on podcast and on iTunes. And until this afternoon, we've got another podcast on this afternoon, 2 in 1 day. So if you want to tune in a bit later on, please do so.
Thanks, Ben. Thanks, everyone.